Today, Sarah Blakely Rose will present and publicly defend her doctoral dissertation. And these are the rules by which we want to do this up there. She will present for about 20 to 25 minutes, at which time she will be the only person speaking in the room. Unless Pepper says something, which I don't I don't foresee her doing. After 30 minutes, then the committee in this today consisting of Jody Reminder, Dr. Greg Robertson, and myself will get to ask her questions. And we will ask her questions as long as time allows or we have breath. If we have run out of questions and if there's still time, then we may open it to members of the faculty to ask questions. And if no one in the faculty actually has questions, then we may allow other participants or other attendants to ask questions of the presenter. So without further ado, yeah. Would you actually tell us who is your party, who are the people attending your presentation, your defense today?
I want to thank my husband. Would you raise your hand, honey? This is Kevin. And my parents, Bob and Cindy Blake. So they have been extremely helpful to me throughout this process. So thank you. And also thank you to you all.
We should hear our comments first.
Yeah. And before I get up and go up there, I want to just note this is one half of my project. No, I'm okay. Okay. Pepper, come. Good girl. No comments, Pepper. Come here. Does anybody have objection to me recording today for the purpose of my memory? I also have requests from the peanut gallery who could not be here for an edited version of the presentation. Does anyone have objection to that? No, thank you. This study concerns the qualitative experiences of students who have completed online Hebrew classes here at Anderson University from the summer of 2015 to the fall of 2018. So the study concerns the definition of success. What does it look like qualitatively for a student to experience success? And how does my decisions in terms of course content and course design and my interaction with students experience that success? If a student finishes Hebrew and has had a painful experience and decides never to use Hebrew again, I haven't done my job in preparing them to use Hebrew for the enrichment of their personal study and ministry. It's always the case that it's their responsibility to take advantage of what I offer and use it to their advantage. But it's also my responsibility to prepare them to do this. In my literature review, I explored issues in second language teaching that overlap with biblical language teaching. These include the importance of working memory. Students have to be able to hold on to what they have read while they're reading something else. Word recognition, they have to be able to recognize the words they're reading. and hold them in memory, and syntactic parsing. They have to be able to relate the words they're reading to other words in the same sentence. In Hebrew, this is important because Hebrew word order is very different from English word order. From here, I looked at the development of interest in the use of second language methods in the teaching of biblical Hebrew. Traditionally, Hebrew has been taught using a method called grammar translation. This means that first people learn the methods of Hebrew grammar, and then they go into translating Hebrew directly into English. The weakness of this method, sometimes students take a while to get into translating biblical texts because the first things that they translate are generic sentences. The textbooks sometimes use complicated terms to explain Hebrew grammar. So if a student has not ever studied a language before, understanding these grammar terms is a stress for them. There are no pictures in these textbooks, so maintaining interest is difficult. People who have become dissatisfied with this method have begun to develop new methods to teach Hebrew. These include the inductive method, which gets students directly into biblical text, and they learn the grammar along the way as they encounter it. This is a less organized method, in some people's opinion, of exposure to grammar. Some people have built courses around theological topics that are of interest to the students. This is somewhat similar to inductive study, but it's inductive study based on theological topics. And the final method is communicative language teaching. So in this method, students speak Hebrew in the classroom and they learn Hebrew vocabulary based on discussion topics. This is more of a modern language method, and students are learning vocabulary that they need in order to speak, and they're not learning so much biblical Hebrew vocabulary. I also reviewed literature regarding teaching languages to people with disabilities. There's not very much literature about teaching languages to people, teaching biblical languages to people with disabilities. In fact, most of it is my own papers. So I went to modern language literature. What I learned here is that people with disabilities are often exempted from language study because the faculty and staff perceive it as too hard. The literature that does exist shows that online media can be helpful or a hindrance. The thing that makes a difference is whether the interface and the media are accessible to people who have disabilities. And I reviewed ways that that can happen. Concerning online courses in general, there are three types of ways to teach online courses. One is when people log in at the same time and they can see each other and hear each other. This is called synchronous learning. Synchronous means at the same time. The second is the online course is part of a larger course design in which people meet in person and the online serves as a supplement. This is called hybrid design. The third is the online course meets not at the same time. People log in on their own time, and they download course materials, and they work on their own time. This is called asynchronous design. The thing that hinders online teaching the most is that it's difficult for people to perceive each other's presence. It's difficult for people to perceive that the other participants in the course are real human beings. There are three types of presence in the online environment. The first one is social, just that people are real. and that they're available. The second one has to do with the impact of technology on the environment. This is called psychological presence. When a person logs into a computer and connects to the course, if they always perceive that the computer is a barrier between themselves and the other people in the class, this is psychological presence. If the computer kind of disappears and they perceive that the classroom environment is real, that psychological presence exists. The third type of presence is emotional presence. This is a type of presence that communicates encouragement and confidence. And this is done with your voice and your words and even with emoticons. We don't like to think about emoticons as professional, but in the online environment, it's sometimes necessary to use them. And you can use your voice in your audio communications. So then when the first Hebrew course went online in 2015, we were not sure how to do this at all because obviously it had never been done before. So we weren't sure if it was going to be successful. Several things needed to happen in order to do this. We knew that we were going to have a blind student. The course was partially motivated by the fact that a blind student had contacted me and said, I need a place to study Hebrew because it's not working where I am. So we knew that he wanted to study here. He needed to be able to access the interface as well as anything that I put up. He needed to be able to read it. The course needed to be something that everyone could navigate, not just this one student. And so I needed to learn how to do this because obviously I know how to create a course that a blind person can navigate, but I had to learn how sighted people think. The textbook needed to be affordable. It needed to be accessible for the blind student. It also needed to still be in print because a lot of times Braille books are done, they're older and they've run out of print. It also needed to provide a proper exposure to Hebrew. So we did it, and we found out that a lot of things didn't work. I actually lost all of the sighted students that dropped. And they left good feedback about things that they liked and things they didn't like. So I started keeping notes about what worked, what didn't work. And we repeated the course in 2016, and I repeated the same things. I kept notes about what worked and what didn't work. And each time the course was offered, I repeated the same process of taking student feedback, finding out who's completing the course, what's working, what doesn't work. This process of observing and taking feedback from students and changing things based on that feedback and then repeating that whole cycle again is called participatory action research. I'm studying my own environment that I teach in, and I'm allowing the students to participate in the research process. That's the most important piece of action research, is that both the instructor that makes the changes and the students are involved in the research process. It's a very vulnerable way to do research because sometimes I find out that things are going really badly and students really don't like something, and I need to make a sincere change, and I have to be vulnerable enough to accept the negative feedback. Action research has been used in a lot of different settings. It's been used in large organizations to study policy changes. It's been used to study cultural behavior. And it's been used in universities. It's also been used in hospitals to study nursing. So the important piece of it is that the leaders who are making the changes are also the researchers who are implementing the research. In addition to the course data that I collected, I also collected responses to a survey and interview. The survey and interview were administered to students who had already completed their courses. And this was done in the spring of 2018. So it was sent out to students who had completed any course before 2018. And some of the students probably weren't checking their email anymore. So the response numbers were very small. And so most of the data that were used in the study came from student communications that were part of the course, student emails, student notes, comments on homework, comments from the discussion board, etc., as well as my own journal entries and comments that were part of the survey and comments that were in the student interviews. So those all became part of the process of analyzing the data. The value of the survey and interview was that it told me that students were not changing their mind about their experiences once they finished Hebrew and came back. Most of them had the same feelings about Hebrew that they left with. Crystal, would you pull that PowerPoint up, please? On the PowerPoint, I have a table. This shows all of the enrollment data. It's a giant table. what it shows is the enrollment rates, the drop rates, how many new students we had each semester versus how many students are continuing on to new courses, etc. I pulled from this table how many individual students we had in Hebrew and what was happening with these individual students. We've had 31 individual students enroll in online Hebrew courses over this period. And at the time of the study completion, 20 of these students have actually completed their course. That's not exactly the number that I want to see, but the important thing is that the most important drop rates have been in 2015 and in the fall of 2017, we had three drop in the very beginning. Seven of these students have completed a full year of first year Hebrew completely or partially online. We've had five of these students complete three or four semesters of Hebrew completely or fully online. As of this point, this is not part of the study. We have actually had all of those five students in Hebrew 4. So the times that we tend to have the most dropping is in Hebrew 1. We had one student drop Hebrew 2, nobody's dropped Hebrew 3 or 4. So that's all for the table. I like those numbers. They show that the Hebrew online courses are stable at this point. The reason for the drop rates in Hebrew 1 is that Hebrew 1 is a course that is permitted for students to take as a foreign language credit in their liberal arts curriculum. And we have students who sign up for it and realize, oh my gosh, this is really hard. I don't want to take this class. That's a normal reason for students to drop Hebrew. And once they get onto Hebrew 2, they're taking it as part of their Christian ministries credits or their Master of Divinity credits, and they're much more serious at that point. I want to see more than statistics, though, in these outcomes, because I want to see students finishing who are happy. I did have one student finish Hebrew. She made an A. She was very unhappy with her experience. She did not enjoy Hebrew. She took it as an elective. And she graded once all the way across her evaluation, including I completed all my homework one. She did every homework assignment, but clearly that shows that she did not have a positive experience with Hebrew, and she was not going to use it. But I want to see happy students, because happy students use their Hebrew, and happy students return to take more Hebrew. So what are the struggles that students face in Hebrew? One is technology. Not everybody's good at technology. And I do as much teaching about how to use technology probably as I do in teaching about Hebrew. There are sometimes tech failures. One student wrote about having all these vocabulary screens open for study, and then her computer shut down. And she said this in her interview. And at the end of her long quotation in interview, she said, "There's a lot of crying at your computer screen sometimes." Her entire quote is included in the study. Anxiety about Hebrew. A lot of students come in and they're afraid of Hebrew. And their ability to quote, to cope with being afraid of Hebrew makes the difference in whether they submit completed assignments and whether they stay in Hebrew. So I spend time working with them on getting them to submit completed assignments and to feel that they actually can do this. And it does make a difference in whether or not they drop. Time management. All of my students work full-time, including the undergrads. Most of them are taking full-time loans in addition to working full-time. Some of them are, in addition to working full-time, they're also in bivocational clergy positions and raising families. That's a lot more than I had to put on. And the next thing is also emotional issues, specifically with regard to loss. Many of my students have experienced multiple losses within the 2-year span, even a 1-year span of the time that they've studied here. The most common request that I get for extensions is because of funerals. I never get requests for extensions because of moves, although most of my students have moved at least once or twice, sometimes 3 times in a year. One of my students travels overseas multiple times in a semester, and he does request extensions because of those travels, because in his words to me, when he travels overseas, he has to adjust to the culture overseas and then adjust to the culture when he returns to the States. For me, that's very legitimate. Change of textbooks. I did change the textbook one semester. I felt that the students needed exposure to some additional concepts in Hebrew that were not provided in the textbook that I was using. So I changed textbooks, and what I found was that the new textbook was not providing them adequate exposure to grammar. So I put it to a vote to the students, and I said, "This is an alternate textbook that you can use." And some of them bought it, and they voted to change textbooks. And I said, for those of you who are going on to Hebrew 2, what this means is that we have to double up on lessons for several weeks. Is this what you want to do? And they said, "Yes, we want to do this." So we took some weeks off to review grammar that they had not had exposure to. And one of my students wrote me an email and said, "You have no idea how much I appreciate this." And we took another 2 weeks off in the spring because I got new students who had not had any of that exposure. They were coming in from a class that used yet another textbook. And we doubled up on assignments in the spring. And most students really appreciated that. grammar exposure. Assignment length. This is a big one because I had assumed 10 items was good. I checked in the book that Dr. Lozano uses, and in that book, in the assignment that is equivalent to where I am with Hebrew to now, there are 13 verses in the exercise. In the assignments that I have been using, one exercise can assign up to 11 verses. That's a big difference in the amount of Hebrew that my students have been translating. So 10 items can have them translating a whole lot of Hebrew. So how do I remediate? The one thing that I have done when I've done all this review with students and I have kept the 2 weeks in the spring is I have posted what I call the review center. So I have a place where there are verb paradigms on screen that students can study. There is old vocabulary that they can review that some of them have possibly not had exposure to because they didn't use my textbook. And there are lectures on all this material. And we have a 2 week review break in the spring that students have to catch up. We use the discussion board to go through some scripture verses, and we have pointers to the review center where they can study. And we have doubled up assignments in the spring, the doubled up lessons in the spring. What does it look like for a student to succeed in Hebrew? I have one student who has gone through Hebrew 4. In Hebrew 4, students have requirements to submit 2 sermon manuscripts and 1 exegesis paper. The student who completed Hebrew 4 has studied a unit on oath formulas. Her sermon manuscript was on Hannah's oath, and she wrote about how Hannah's oath was a response to God's promise and how God is not required to make oaths to us. It was brilliant. One student in Hebrew 3 wrote about the valley of dry bones in his sermon manuscript. He tied it to his exegesis paper. And he made a point that the valley of dry bones was a valley of death. And that it's hard for us to identify with this kind of experience, that we don't experience a literal valley of death, but that this is a place of God's miracles, and that we experience emotional valleys of death. He tied this in and created a training pamphlet that he could use in his pastoral setting, because he trains other pastors, and I hope he's intending to use that. He's now in Hebrew 4, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he does next. I was very blown away by this. And I see that my 25 minutes are finished, so I'm going to turn it over to the committee, and I'm going to...